content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, dated January 14th, 2011. And thanks for joining me today. The lead story in The Week magazine this week is Republicans Assume a Share of Power. What happened? A new Republican majority took control of the House of Representatives this week with a show of fealty to the Constitution and promises to cut spending, repeal President Obama's health care reform plan, and aggressively roll back environmental regulations. Speaker of the House John Boehner began laying symbolic markers for what's likely to be a session of trench warfare against Democrats in the White House and the Senate majority. Republicans retreated from their vow to cut $100 billion from the current budget, saying they would seek $60 billion in cuts to bring 2011 spending levels down to the 2008 level. The people voted to end business as usual, Boehner said, and today we begin carrying out their instructions. In coming weeks, GOP House leaders plan to call for a largely symbolic vote to repeal the Democrats' health care plan, despite little chance of success in the Democratic-controlled Senate, and promise to do everything possible to impede the legislation's implementing and funding. President Obama said he expected Republicans to play to their base for a certain period of time before joining him in the tasks of government and job creation. Now here's what the editorials had to say. This week's GOP ascendance marks perhaps the sharpest ideological shift in the House in 80 years, said the Wall Street Journal. Yet despite the deficit-cutting fervor of Tea Party activists, GOP leaders should keep the political and policy focus on promoting economic growth and private job creation. Thanks to Obama and Nancy Pelosi's failures, the public is giving Republicans another chance to lead on the economy. They'll squander that chance if they turn into mere deficit scolds. Let the cheap theatrics begin, said the New York Times. With their staged reading of the Constitution, Republicans have cast themselves as the chosen few who know the true meaning of the text. The equally symbolic vote to repeal the Democrats' health care law, meanwhile, is the legislative equivalent of an obscene gesture, said the Financial Times, and hardly bodes well for comedy. The White House and Republicans are now stuck with each other, and unless they act like adults, everything that is wrong with Washington is about to get worse. Now here's what the columnist said. The binge is over, said Rich Lowry in National Review. The new GOP majority is genuinely determined to deliver on its promise to limit government. Nearly 90 members of the Republican caucus are freshmen shaped in the crucible of the Tea Party. A big test will come by March 4th when funding for the government runs out, requiring the debt ceiling to be raised to avoid shutting down the government. But Republican zeal for spending cuts must be matched by strategic canny. They must beware repeating the shutdown debacle that haunted Newt Gingrich and the GOP in the 1990s. Many pitfalls await the new House majority, said Matt Bai in the New York Times. Tea Party activists will expect them to make good on their promises to make a big dent in spending and the deficit. But polls show that when it comes to specific programs, sizable majorities of voters are opposed to making any sacrifice whatsoever. The only thing voters like less than a gushing federal spigot is being forced to shut it off. Before addressing specific programs, said Roger Pilon in the Wall Street Journal, the GOP should restore adherence to the Constitution. It will take years to roll back Obama's arrogant intrusion into health care, energy policy, and private industry. But by demanding that all policies and legislation have a constitutional basis, Republicans can begin to usher in a new age of limited government. Fine, let's have that grand debate, said E.G. Dionne in the New Republic Online. Now that Republicans have a share of power, they will be forced to show their policy and philosophical cards. with the Tea Party pushing them from the right and 62 GOP House members representing swing districts won by Obama, the Republicans' balancing act will be one of the best stories of the next 2 years. The second big story this past week was a video scandal fells Navy skipper. The Navy stripped Captain Owen P. Honors of command of the aircraft carrier Enterprise this week after revelations that he had produced lewd videos and broadcast them to thousands of sailors on the vessel's closed-circuit television. As the Enterprise's second-in-command during 2006 and 2007, Honors starred in elaborate video skits that mocked homosexuals and showed officers pretending to masturbate and eat feces. He leeringly introduced one episode as "My favorite topic, something foreign to the gay kid over there, chicks in the shower." A Facebook support group that includes former Enterprise shipmates emerged quickly to defend Honors and his movie nights, which Honors apparently considered morale boosters. But the Navy cited the former F-14 Top Gun pilot for profound lack of good judgment and professionalism, and they assigned him to a desk job in Norfolk, Virginia. "What's next?" said Daniel Foster in National Review Online. "Sensitivity training for drill sergeants? Something's deeply wrong when the commander of a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the greatest instrument of American power projection ever devised, is sacrificed to the PC gods for a couple of off-color jokes. The worst part," said William Van Slyke in the New York Daily News, "is the abject hypocrisy of television news organizations decrying the video's inappropriateness before returning to their regularly scheduled, deeply inappropriate programming. Honors' videos are far less offensive than any single episode of The Family Guy." "This was no boys will be boys prank," said Glenn McNatt in the BaltimoreSun.com. "A naval captain should know by now that misogyny, sexual harassment, and gay bashing are unacceptable. They've been out of fashion since the 1991 tailhook scandal when naval aviators sexually assaulted women at a convention. Yet many in the Navy still don't get it," said Michael S. Locher in the Norfolk, Virginian Pilot. "The fact that so many see nothing wrong in Honor's actions is even more appalling than what he did. Now that his career is over, Honors could seal his distinguished service to the nation by explaining to his many supporters why he was wrong. That would prevent Honors' venial sin from becoming the Navy's mortal wound." Our next item is entitled Benefits for 9/11 Rescue Workers. President Obama this week signed legislation providing $4.2 billion in federal health benefits and damages to firefighters, police, and other rescue workers who were sickened by toxic dust and fumes while responding to the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center. The bill will be paid for by a new fee on foreign companies that get U.S. procurement contracts. It was passed in the final hours of the last Congress, despite Republican opposition led by Senators Tom Coburn of Oklahoma and Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who argue that it was overgenerous and would worsen the federal deficit and invite fraud and abuse. But Republicans dropped their filibuster and negotiated a downsized bill after TV satirist Jon Stewart highlighted the issue with withering commentary on The Daily Show. After 9/11, more than 70,000 first responders from New York and other states worked in the Trade Center's smoldering rubble for weeks, looking for survivors and bodies. Hundreds later developed scarred lungs and other respiratory problems, damaged gastrointestinal tracts, or cancers. Health professionals testified before Congress that the illnesses were related to inhaling the toxic cloud that lingered over the Trade Center site, including pulverized concrete, glass, and other building materials, jet fuel fumes, and a stew of chemicals. "Paying for the rescue workers' medical care is right and it is just," said the New York Daily News in an editorial. "In vast battalions, they searched for the missing and then the dead. They were poisoned as they labored. Most did not wear protective masks because Christine Whitman, then the head of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, assured them the air was safe. How shameful that too many Republicans in the House and Senate viewed these ailing heroes as something of an annoyance. There's no shame in asking hard questions about how the taxpayers' money is spent, said John McCormick in theweeklystandard.com. Thanks to Coburn's objections, a $7.4 billion bill was reduced to $4.2 billion, and a 10% cap was put on trial lawyers' fees. Stewart called Republican opposition insane. But what's really nuts is insisting that a government with a trillion-dollar deficit should be spending more money. Now let's take a look at the controversy of the week, entitled Healthcare, the Return of Death Panels. The American people mustn't fall for the same trick twice, said Mary Sanchez in Newsday. Back in 2009, former Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin memorably denounced what she called the death panels that would be created by President Obama's health care reform plan. Government bureaucrats, she insisted, would now decide whether to deny medical care to old people. Palin's claim was patently false, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial, but it had an effect. The Democrats had to delete the offending clause, which turned out to be an innocuous provision giving Medicare reimbursement to doctors for talking with patients about end-of-life decisions. Would they want to be kept alive through the use of feeding tubes, ventilators, and other extraordinary measures? Medicare, thankfully, will pay for the humane conversation. After all, Obama last week authorized new Medicare rules that include paying for end-of-life consultations between doctors and patients if the patient wants to have that talk. By encouraging people to think ahead and put their wishes in a living will or other document, this rule gives patients more control over what happens to them in the hospital should they become incapacitated by illness. Obviously, the left still can't admit that Sarah Palin had a point, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. We'll concede that her death panel rhetoric was sensationalistic, but her underlying critique of Obamacare was valid. Any centrally administered health care system will inevitably make cost-minded judgments about what types of care should be provided to which categories of patient. Government technocrats may decide, for example, that it's a waste of money to give expensive treatments to people deemed terminal or too old. That's where the end-of-life counseling comes in, said Peter Roth in USNews.com. By incentivizing doctors to provide such counseling to the elderly in a system that necessarily rations care, the overwhelming likelihood is that patients will be pressured into choosing the least expensive end-of-life options, that is, those that bring about their death sooner rather than later. But death panels are already here, said Norman Ornstein in the Washington Post. In cash-strapped states like Indiana and Arizona, both governed by Republicans, for the record, teams of government bureaucrats are making painful choices about which patients deserve a share of dwindling state Medicaid funds. Indiana officials last year refused to pay for a $500,000 operation that might save the life of a 6-year-old boy, while in Arizona, the state cut off reimbursements for organ transplants procedures for the poor. The new end-of-life planning provision is nothing like that, said the Portland Oregonian in an editorial. If patients don't want to discuss end-of-life care with their doctors, they don't have to. There is nothing to fear here. As a practicing physician, I'm not so sure, said Dr. Mark Siegel in the New York Daily News. Today, I rarely can say with any certainty that patients are terminal because we have such sophisticated tools to combat life-threatening illness. I'm fully aware, however, that Medicare spent $55 billion last year on just the last 2 months of elderly patients' lives. And with the baby boom generation growing old, that figure is sure to soar. For Obama to bend the cost curve, as he promised reform would do, the cost of end-of-life care has to be cut. That's why doctors like me will now be paid to persuade the elderly not to linger on. Now let's take a look at the very popular column entitled Good Week For and Bad Week For from The Week magazine. The entrepreneurial spirit, it was a good week for that, after muscular rapper 50 Cent responded to a recent blizzard by renting himself out to shovel his wealthy Connecticut neighbor's driveways. 50 charged $100 per mansion, with an additional charge for photos of him shoveling. It was a good week for sanitizing history after an Alabama publisher said it would release an edited version of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in which 219 uses of the N-word will be replaced with slave. And it was a good week for honesty after Ferhat Kaya of Belgium found $393,630 in a safe in a former bank building he bought for his accounting company. After painstakingly counting the cash, he turned the money in to the police. Now, it was a bad week for lionfish after environmentalists released the Lionfish Cookbook in response to the recent invasion of the predatory and ravenous fish in Florida waters. Lionfish are delicious table fare with a delicate buttery flavor, said the Reef Environmental Education Foundation. It was a bad week for polygamy after a Pakistani man was publicly beaten by two of his three wives, who accused him of having a secret fourth wife and planning to marry a fifth one. "I am willing to swear on my life that I only have three wives," said Mian Ishak. And it was a bad week for heathens after Harold Camping, leader of a nationwide Christian radio ministry, announced that without a shadow of a doubt, May 21st, 2011, will be the day of judgment and the rapture. Billboard signs in several cities are warning that the end is getting very near. Now let's turn to the People section of the Week magazine. The first item here is entitled, When O'Rourke Moved Right. P.J. O'Rourke came to his conservatism in a roundabout way, says Helen Brown in the London Telegraph. The humor writer arrived at college in the late 1960s as a staunch Republican, but found he wasn't handsome enough to attract the wealthy, preppy girls. So he grew his hair long and became a hippie to lure the lefty girls. It worked, but, after he graduated and began working, disillusionment set in. More than a third of his paycheck was gone before he ever saw it. "I'd been struggling for years to achieve socialism in America," O'Rourke says, "only to discover that we had it already." He became a Republican, but a libertarian one, given his long fondness for substance use. "I think drugs are fun," he says, "but now that he's both a parent and a conservative, I think fun is bad. He doesn't spare his children his acerbic wit. Recently," he says, "his teenage daughter was complaining, 'Life is not fair. Life is not fair.' I got fed up," I said. "You're cute. That's not fair. You're smart. That's not fair. Your family's well off. That's not fair. You were born in the U.S. That's not fair. Darling, you better get down on your knees and pray that things don't start getting fair for you." And the next item from the People column here is, Why Mick Prefers to be single. "Don't count on Mick Jagger settling down anytime soon," said Zoe Heller in the London Times. The Rolling Stones vocalist, who is 67 years old now, has tried it before with wives Bianca, who divorced him in 1978, and Jerry Hall, whom he left in 1999. "To be honest, I don't really think much of marriage," Jagger says. "I'm not saying it's not a wonderful thing, but it's not for me." Given his philandering, what comes next is unsurprising. "I don't really subscribe to a completely normal view of what relationship should be. I have a bit more bohemian view." He insists that his disinterest in monogamy doesn't mean he's not supportive of his paramours. For the past decade, he's been kind of dating designer Loren Scott, and he shows up at many of her fashion shows to give her career a little boost. "When I was with Jerry Hall, I used to help her pick her model pictures. That's what you do. But being faithful? If you've studied or have even a passing knowledge of animal behavior, it's hard to see how our rules and regulations fit in. But what about swans who mate for life?" Jagger rolls his eyes. "Oh, yeah. I love it when women say that." And And you're listening to a reading of The Week magazine for January 14th, 2011. One of the regular features of The Week magazine is a briefing, and this week's briefing is entitled Trouble in the Eurozone. The 17-nation European Currency Union is fracturing as the haves battle the have-nots. How does the Eurozone work? When it was introduced in 2002, Europe's common currency, the euro, represented a bold step toward uniting member nations in a transnational economy that now rivals the U.S. in output. In return for membership, each country in the Eurozone, there are now 17, Austria, Belgium, Cyprus, Estonia, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Ireland, Italy, Luxembourg, Malta, the Netherlands, Portugal, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Spain, each of them agrees to contribute to the European Central Bank, keep government debt within defined limits, and check inflation. At the same time, however, each member retains control over its budget and tax policies, and there is no formal mechanism for disciplining members that violate the currency union's fiscal guidelines. Is that the source of the conflict? Yes, a financial crisis in Greece last spring pitted the European Union's largest and wealthiest members, France and Germany, against the debt-plagued nations on Europe's southern and western periphery. Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, their initials form the derisive acronym PIGS, are all struggling now to balance shaky budgets with outsized deficits, and they're seeking help from their more solvent neighbors. So far, the EU and the International Monetary Fund have provided more than $225 billion in aid to Greece and Ireland. But with Portugal and Spain also in financial trouble, few analysts think the bailouts are over. How do France and Germany feel about that? Furious. Both countries want to avoid becoming the deep pocket to the rest of Europe, said financier George Soros. As the largest economies in the Union and the largest contributors to the central bank, Germany and France exert greater power over policymaking, but they also shoulder a greater burden in bailouts. A poll last spring revealed that 80% of Germans opposed bailing out Greece. Their discontent increased pressure on German Chancellor Angela Merkel to demand more onerous bailout terms, which in turn fueled violent protests in Greece. The entire country has no sense of responsibility, Berliner Karen Schumann complained of Greece, and now we're supposed to fix it. How have the markets reacted? Currency and bond traders have been punishing Europe for its disarray. The value of the euro, a barometer of market confidence in the Union's financial and political soundness, hit a four-year low in May during the worst of the Greek crisis. Meanwhile, bond traders have expressed their skepticism of the pigs by selling off their government bonds, which forces the bonds' prices down and their yields up. That only exacerbates the pigs' financial problems, further undermining confidence. How much does that cost? Over time, billions. Consider Portugal's December auction of $663 million in three-month treasury bills. Because of rising doubts about Portugal's solvency, its government had to pay an average interest rate of 3.4% on the December bonds, nearly twice what it paid in November. If bond markets continue demanding higher interest rates from the Eurozone's weaklings, the sheer burden of dealing with the interest starts to overwhelm the economy, said Julian Callow, chief European economist at Barclays Capital. What would calm the markets? A signal that Eurozone nations are politically in sync, capable of jointly defending their currency and strengthening member finances. In December, members voted to create a bailout fund to be tapped in the event of future financial troubles. But the agreement doesn't specify the size of the fund or the conditions under which a nation can tap it, leading many to doubt its soundness. Meanwhile, Spain's $1.4 trillion economy, double the combined economies of Portugal, Ireland, and Greece, is teetering. To forestall another round of crises, many investors and politicians favor allowing the European Central Bank to issue bonds on behalf of the entire eurozone. That would lower the borrowing costs of poorer nations, but increase them for France and Germany, leading Germany's Merkel to steadfastly oppose the idea. With hard feelings all around, Luxembourg's foreign minister, Jean Asselborn, reacted by accusing Germany of haughtiness and arrogance. Is the European Union itself at risk? Incredibly, it might be. The failure of the euro and thus of the EU and its common market would be the biggest pan-European disaster since 1945, said former German foreign minister Joschka Fischer. This outcome is possible despite protestations to the contrary by all involved. Tensions between nations are rising, with Germany recently proposing that bailed-out nations share the pain of future bailouts. That announcement caused an immediate sell-off of Irish government debt as investors dumped bonds that, under the German plan, might never be repaid in full. The Irish public erupted in fury over the harsh austerity measures imposed as terms of the bailout. Some see these events as signs that the Union is unraveling. By my current best guess, said Financial Times columnist Gideon Rackman, is that the single currency will indeed eventually break up, and that the euro's executioner will be Germany. And the cutout section in the briefing for this week is entitled Dark Suspicions in Dublin. In late November, more than 100,000 Irish citizens marched in Dublin to protest the hefty tax hikes and public service cuts that the European Union and the International Monetary Fund exacted in exchange for an $89 billion bailout. But in addition to denouncing the bailout deal and the Irish government that had accepted it, protesters swapped conspiracy theories about the nefarious role played by Germany in the affair. One popular theory holds that Germany deliberately sparked a run on Irish bonds, thereby forcing a reluctant Irish government to impose austerity measures. This is not a rescue plan, said writer and political commentator Fintan O'Toole. It's the longest ransom note in history. True or not, O'Toole's statement is typical of the resentment Europe's have-nots feel toward the continent's wealthier nations, especially Germany. You're listening to a reading of The Week magazine, dated January 14th, 2011. And just in case you're wondering, and you had not heard our previous conversations about this, but we are no longer reading from U.S. News & World Report because that esteemed publication shut down in the month of December. December 2010 was the final publication of U.S. News & World Report, and also the online service went dead as well. So from now on, we're reading only for the Week magazine for the full hour. And quite honestly, that gives us a little bit more time to cover some of the articles that we were not able to cover in the past. So we hope very much that you enjoy this, and I thank you for joining me today. The next item that we're going to read is a new one from the Week magazine that we haven't been able to include in the past, and it's called The Best Columns in the U.S., and also followed up by The Best Columns in Europe. And these are especially interesting, and I hope you enjoy hearing them. The first column is entitled Palin's Chances Are Dwindling, and it's by Jonathan Bernstein of the WashingtonPost.com. As a celebrity and money-making machine, Sarah Palin was hugely successful in 2010, said Jonathan Bernstein. But as a possible presidential candidate, Palin had a very bad year. The Sage of Wasilla raked in millions with her books, Fox News deal, and reality TV series, but failed to convince anyone outside her small circle of personal loyalists that she's qualified to be president. Yes, she sent forth a handful of ghostwritten op-eds and made a few serious policy speeches, but they failed to persuade even Republicans that she has the slightest grasp on policy. Is there anyone who wrote her off as a lightweight who is now giving her a new look because of her speech on the Fed? I very much doubt it. Her poll numbers among independents remain awful, and most GOP leaders view her as unelectable. If she runs, Palin will be nothing more than a factional candidate, adored by blue-collar social conservatives and distrusted by everyone else. It's not too late for her, but if she doesn't start sounding like a credible candidate very soon, she has very little chance of being nominated and none of being elected. The next column highlighted in the week this week is entitled The Spiritual Poverty of Recession, and it's by Gregory Rodriguez in the Los Angeles Times. Recessions are devastating for those who lose their jobs, said Gregory Rodriguez, but they haven't been the only casualties of 3 years of hard times. America's animal spirits, our vitality and optimism, are now at the lowest ebb in memory, and we are all poorer as a result. When the economy began unraveling in 2007, critics told us how a little belt tightening would be good for our consumerist souls. Instead, it was enervating. Money, studies show, may not buy happiness, but what such studies don't measure is the happiness we derive from dreaming about the money and scheming to get it. Americans work not merely to survive, but in pursuit of better, richer lives. Recessions kill that thrill and diminish that joy. Instead of cooking up new ideas, reinventing ourselves, and taking risks, we spend more energy trying merely to survive or hang on to the gigs we have. We become more obsessed with money. When there's less of it floating around, let's hope 2011 brings a real and lasting recovery. We need the money, but we also need the excitement of possibilities, the optimistic embrace of risk to re-enter our lives. And the third column, identified this week as one of the best by The Week magazine, is entitled An Absence of Women in Power, written by Stephanie McNulty from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Women are finally gaining a foothold on political power through the Americas, except in one nation, said Stephanie McNulty. That nation is the United States. Brazil just swore in its first female president, Dilma Rousseff, the fifth woman to head a Latin American nation in the past two decades, but in the U.S., no woman has ever been nominated for president by a major party. And after the recent congressional elections, the number of women holding seats actually declined to 16.4%. We now rank 72nd in female legislative representation, below such paragons of modernity as Cambodia, Ecuador, and Uganda. Does it matter if 50% of the population is fairly represented in office? It sure does. Female leaders are more likely to focus on issues important to women, such as women's health, sexual harassment, and the well-being of children and families. America needs to ask itself why so few smart, ambitious women get elected here, or even dare to seek office. As long as they are portrayed primarily as witches, bitches, or bimbos, we will continue to fall behind our neighbors in this crucial aspect of a healthy democracy. Now let's take a look at the two best columns identified in Europe. From the United Kingdom, the column is entitled Where Inmates Live It Up in Prison, written by Stephen Glover in the Daily Mail. Britain is outrageously lax and indulgent toward criminals, said Stephen Glover. Just how soft it is was revealed last weekend after inmates in the Ford Open Prison, a minimum security facility in England's southeast, rioted when prison guards had the effrontery to try to take away their smuggled alcohol. The effort was a farce, literally. Witnesses said it was like a scene out of Benny Hill as wardens waving breathalyzers chased inmates futilely around the yard. I'm surprised they even bothered, since everything we have learned in the aftermath of the riot makes Ford sound much more like a holiday camp, albeit a highly dysfunctional one, than a properly run prison. One former prisoner said the entire facility is permeated with alcohol because some of the more trusted inmates are allowed to jump over the fence, nip down to Tesco, which is just down the road, and buy liquor. Women are routinely smuggled in, and there are few guards on duty because most of the prison's budget has gone toward installing new snooker tables. Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark has been outspoken in his criticism of incarceration, saying it doesn't serve as a disincentive to committing crimes. Well, no wonder. When prison is so much fun, why would anyone try to avoid it? The next column from Europe is from Hungary, where freedom of the press is dead. And it's an editorial from a publication called Net Szabadság. Hungary enjoyed just 2 decades of press freedom, and now it's over, says Budapest Net Szabadság. After communism fell in 1989, this former Warsaw Pact country saw a blossoming of free thought, as newspapers were able to publish any political opinion without fear of repression. As of January 1, 2011, though, anyone who disagrees with the government can be silenced, punished, and in the long term banished from our national media. It's a black day for the country. The ruling coalition of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's center-right Fidesz party and the Christian Democrats has rammed through a law to muzzle the press and advance their authoritarian agenda. Individual political commentators and the newspapers that publish them can be fined repeatedly for any writings that a new government agency deems to be contrary to the public interest, public morals, or public order. The 5 members of the agency, all appointed by Fidesz, will be able to fine any paper that criticizes their party. We already have a state-owned media, all too willing to sing the praises of government. Are we now going to silence all other voices? And finally, from Best Columns Internationally, here's one from Egypt, covering the issue, why are Coptic Christians under attack? A heinous massacre has shattered interfaith harmony in Egypt, said Pakistan's Daily Times in an editorial. A suicide bomber struck a midnight service at a Coptic Christian church in Alexandria over New Year's, killing 23 people and wounding scores of others. While no group has claimed responsibility, suspicion immediately fell on an Iraqi group linked to al-Qaeda, which has threatened to attack the Coptic church for allegedly kidnapping 2 Coptic women who wanted to convert to Islam. Instead of falling for their propaganda, Muslims should join hands and fight the scourge of terrorism. The attack hit Egypt, but its target was all people of faith everywhere. We must show Christians and indeed the world that Islam is a religion of peace. Spare us the hypocrisy, said Coptic journalist Hani Shukala in Cairo's Al Aram. Egyptian Muslims have denounced anti-Christian violence many times over the years, yet the massacres continue, each more horrible than the one before it, and the bigotry and intolerance spread deeper and wider into every nook and cranny of our society. It's far too easy to blame al-Qaeda or whichever fundamentalist carried out this latest attack. The real culpability lies deeper. I accuse the Egyptian government, which coddles and appeases extremists in the hope of siphoning support from the opposition Muslim Brotherhood. I accuse my fellow Christians who fail to show a minimum of backbone and stand up for their rights. But most of all, I accuse the millions of supposedly moderate Muslims who toss out casual slurs against arrogant cops. Don't let this terrorist act create mistrust between Christian and Muslim Arabs, said Saudi Arabia's Al-Watan in an editorial. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak himself said he believed outsiders were to blame, and we suspect which ones. Most likely it was an Israeli hand seeking to ignite the situation in the region. But blaming outsiders is not productive, said Lebanon's Daily Star. All the ingredients for sectarian strife exist in Egypt in abundance. Extremism, after all, mostly takes root in societies with a large percentage of unemployed, poor, uneducated people. Egypt has millions of such unfortunates from both religions. That's a large recruitment pool for terrorists of any stripe. Until the contributing factors for terrorism are addressed, calls for religious harmony will do little good. Each week in the Week magazine, there's a special feature that appears towards the end of the magazine, and it's called The Last Word. And each week I find it very entertaining, and I hope you will as well. This particular item is entitled, Why We Procrastinate. Is it just a bad habit, asked James Surowiecki in The New Yorker, or is something profound at work when we are not? Some years ago, the economist George Akerlof found himself faced with a simple task, mailing a box of clothes from India, where he was living, to the United States. The clothes belonged to his friend Joseph Stiglitz, who had left them behind when visiting, so Akerlof was eager to send the box off. But there was a problem. The combination of Indian bureaucracy and what Akerlof called my own ineptitude in such matters meant that doing so was going to be a hassle. Indeed, he estimated that it would take an entire workday. So he put off dealing with it week after week. This went on for more than 8 months, and it was only shortly before Akerlof himself returned home that he managed to solve the problem. Another friend happened to be sending some things back to the U.S., and Akerlof was able to add Stiglitz's clothes to the shipment. It's possible that Akerlof made it back to the States before Stiglitz's shirts did. There's something comforting about this story. Even Nobel-winning economists procrastinate, but Akerlof saw the experience for all its familiarity as mysterious. He had genuinely intended to send the box to his friend, yet, as he wrote in a paper called Procrastination and Obedience in 1991, each morning for over 8 months I woke up and decided that the next morning would be the day to send the Stiglitz box. Akerlof, who became one of the central figures in behavioral economics, came to the realization that procrastination might be more than just a bad habit. He argued that it reveals something important about the limits of rational thinking. Since his essay was published, the study of procrastination has become a significant field in academia, with philosophers, psychologists, and economists all weighing in. The economist George Ainslie argues that dragging our heels is as fundamental as the shape of time and could well be called the basic impulse. But anxiety about it as a serious problem seems to have emerged relatively recently in the early modern era. The term procrastination, derived from a Latin word meaning to put off for tomorrow, entered the English language in the 16th century. And by the 18th century, Samuel Johnson was describing it as one of the general weaknesses that prevail to a greater or less degree in every mind. The problem seems to be getting worse. According to Piers Steele, a business professor at the University of Calgary, the percentage of people who admitted to difficulties with procrastination quadrupled between 1978 and 2002. In that light, it's possible to see procrastination as the quintessential modern problem. It's also a surprisingly costly one. Each year, Americans waste hundreds of millions of dollars because they don't file their taxes on time. The Harvard economist David Leibson has shown that American workers have foregone huge amounts of money in matching 401k contributions because they never got around to signing up for a retirement plan. The recent crisis of the euro was exacerbated by the German government's dithering and the decline of the American auto industry, exemplified by the bankruptcy of GM, was due in part to executives' penchant for delaying tough decisions. Procrastination is a powerful example of what the Greeks called akrasia, doing something against one's own better judgment. Steele defines procrastination as willingly deferring something even though you expect the delay to make you worse off. This is the perplexing thing about procrastination. Although it seems to involve avoiding unpleasant tasks, indulging in it generally doesn't make people happy. In one study, 65% of students surveyed before they started working on a term paper said they would like to avoid procrastinating. They knew both that they wouldn't do the work on time and that the delay would make them unhappy. most of the contributors to a new book on the subject, The Thief of Time, edited by Crisola Andrao and Mark D. White from Oxford, agree that this peculiar irrationality stems from our relationship to time, in particular from a tendency that economists call hyperbolic discounting. A two-stage experiment provides an illustration. In the first stage, people are offered the choice between $100 today or $110 tomorrow. In the second stage, they choose between $100 a month from now or $110 a month and a day from now. In substance, the two choices are identical. Wait an extra day, get an extra $10. Yet in the first stage, many people choose to take the smaller sum immediately, whereas in the second, they prefer to wait one more day and get the extra $10. In other words, hyperbolic discounters are able to make the rational choice when they're thinking about the future, but as the present gets closer, short-term considerations overwhelm their long-term goals. A similar phenomenon is at work in an experiment in which people were asked to pick one movie to watch that night, and one to watch at a later date. Now, for the movie they wanted to watch immediately, people tended to pick lowbrow comedies and blockbusters. But when asked what movie they wanted to watch later, they were more likely to pick serious, important films. The problem, of course, is that when the time comes to watch the serious movie, another frothy one will often seem more appealing. We want to do the responsible, serious thing, but our desires shift as the long run becomes the short run, and so we often fail to do what we had planned to do. One reason for this might be ignorance. Many of us, it seems, underestimate how powerful the distractions of the present will be. We also succumb to what the social scientist John Elster calls the planning fallacy. Elster thinks that people underestimate the time it will take them to complete a given task, partly because they fail to take into account how long it has taken them to complete similar projects in the past, and partly because they rely on smooth scenarios in which accidents or unforeseen problems never occur. When I was writing this piece, for instance, I had to take my car into the shop. I had to take two unanticipated trips. A family member felt ill, and so on. Each of these events was, strictly speaking, unexpected, and each took time away from my work. But they were really just the kinds of problems you predictably have to deal with in everyday life. Pretending I wouldn't have any interruptions to my work was a typical illustration of the planning fallacy. Still, ignorance can't be the whole story, since we do learn from experience. Chronic procrastinators know about the distractions of the present and want to resist them, but don't. So a fuller account of procrastination needs to take into account the way we feel about the tasks we're avoiding. General George McClellan, who led the Army of the Potomac during the early years of the Civil War, was considered a military genius, but he soon became famous for his chronic hesitancy. In 1862, despite an excellent opportunity to take Richmond from Robert E. Lee's men, he dilly-dallied and missed his chance. Later that year, both before and after Antietam, he similarly squandered a 2-to-1 advantage over Lee's troops. Afterward, Union General-in-Chief Henry Halleck wrote, "It requires the lever of Archimedes to move this inert mass." McClellan was, in many ways, a classic procrastinator. He was unsure that he could accomplish the tasks before him, and he was given to excessive planning, as if only the perfect strategy was worth doing. Lack of confidence, sometimes alternating with unrealistic dreams of heroic success, often leads to procrastination. Rather than risk failure, procrastinators create conditions that make success impossible. Viewed this way, procrastination looks less like a question of ignorance than like a complex mixture of weaknesses, ambition, and inner conflict. But some of the philosophers in The Thief of Time have a more radical explanation for the gap between what we want to do and what we end up doing. The person who makes plans and the person who fails to carry them out are not the same person. Game theorist Tom Schelling proposes that each of us is a divided self, containing different beings jostling, contending, and bargaining for control. Faust complained about having two souls in his breast. Otto von Bismarck said, "But I harbor a whole crowd of them, and they quarrel. It is like being in a republic." For the philosopher Don Ross, the various parts of the self constantly compete. Various parts of the self constantly compete and bargain with one another. One wants to work, one wants to watch television, and so on. The key for Ross is that although the television watching self is interested only in watching TV, it's interested in watching TV not just now, but also in the future. This means that it can be bargained with. Working now will let you watch more television later. Procrastination in this reading results from a bargaining process gone wrong. The idea of the divided self can be liberating in practical terms because it encourages you to stop thinking about procrastination as something you can beat by just trying harder. Instead, we should rely on what Joseph Heath and Joel Anderson call the extended will, external tools to help the parts of ourselves that want to work. Ulysses provides a classic illustration of the extended will. Ulysses knows that when he hears the sirens, he will be too weak to resist steering the ship onto the rocks in pursuit of them. So he has his men bind him to the mast, forcing him to adhere to his long-term aims. Similarly, Thomas Schelling once said that he would be willing to pay extra for a hotel room without a television in it. A few years ago, Dan Ariely, a psychologist at MIT, did a fascinating experiment examining one of the most basic external tools for dealing with procrastination, deadlines. Students in a class were assigned three papers for the semester, and they were given a choice. They could set separate deadlines for when they had to hand in each of the papers, or they could hand them all in together at the end of the semester. There was no benefit to handing the papers in early, and there was a potential cost to setting the deadlines, since if you missed a deadline, your grade would be docked. The rational thing to do was to hand in all the papers at the end of the semester. That way you'd be free to write the papers sooner, but not at risk of a penalty if you didn't get around to it. Yet, most of the students chose separate deadlines for each paper, precisely because they knew they were otherwise unlikely to work on the papers early. This is the essence of the extended will. Instead of trusting themselves, the students relied on an outside tool, deadlines. It's hard to ignore the fact that all these tools are at root about imposing limits and narrowing options. In other words, about a voluntary abnegation of freedom. Victor Hugo would write naked and tell his valet to hide his clothes so that he'd be unable to go outside when he was supposed to be writing. But before we rush to overcome procrastination, we should consider whether it is sometimes an impulse we should heed. The philosopher Mark Kingwell puts it in existential terms. Procrastination most often arises from a sense that there is too much to do and hence no single aspect of the to-do worth doing. Underneath this rather antic form of action as inaction is the much more unsettling question whether anything is worth doing at all. In that sense, it might be useful to think about two kinds of procrastination, the kind that is genuinely acratic and the kind that's telling you that what you're supposed to be doing has no real point. The procrastinator's challenge, and perhaps the philosopher's too, is to figure out which is which. And one of the special features in The Week magazine this week is a review of films for the previous year. Critics' Choices, the best films of 2010. Let's take a look at the top 10 films for the year. The number one film for the year, The Social Network. This fictionalized account of how Mark Zuckerberg created Facebook is one of the rare big studio efforts that ravished the audience with sheer intelligence, said David Denby in The New Yorker. Thanks to David Fincher's deft direction and Aaron Sorkin's fantastically clever script, The Social Network is a near-perfect exhibition of observation, temperament, and will. The second movie, according to the critics for 2010, Toy Story 3. There's a reason Pixar has become a staple on top 10 lists since the first Toy Story. It is the gold standard of animation, said David Anson in Newsweek. The final installment of the studio's signature trilogy finds Woody and his toy cronies dealing with the terror of abandonment as Andy, their owner, heads to college. An affecting tale that mixes dark poetry with nonstop inventiveness. It managed to make grown men cry. The third most popular film, The Winter's Bone. This atmospheric tale about a teenage girl's desperate search for her fugitive father in the impoverished Ozarks was by leagues my favorite movie of 2010, said David Edelstein in New York. Deborah Granick's harshly beautiful adaptation of a Daniel Woodrell novel archives mythical intensity as this proud poor girl, played by a remarkable Jennifer Lawrence, steps up to save her family from disillusion. The fourth most popular film in 2010, Inception. Inception demands to be seen again and again, said the AV Club. Director Christopher Nolan's tale about a mind invader, Leo DiCaprio, sweeps us away into an impressive dream world and worlds of dreams within dreams, while offering a thrilling, emotionally affecting film about desire, disappointment, and delusion. The film keeps us intrigued and confounded until the end. Even the final shot is a mystery never to be solved. The fifth most popular film, The Kids Are All Right. The smartest, funniest, sexiest film of the year featured a nuclear family with a modern twist, said Lisa Schwartzbaum in Entertainment Weekly. In this drama, or rather in this dramedy, from Lisa Chodolenko, Annette Bening and Julianne Moore star as lesbian mothers whose children want to meet the man who fathered them. The script is so cleverly subverts sitcom-style conventions that it erases the boundaries between gay content and universal family content. The sixth most popular movie of the year, The King's Speech. Colin Firth and Jeffrey Rush put in masterful performances as a stammering King George VI and his speech therapist in this charming drama, said Joe Morgenstern in the Wall Street Journal. Director Tom Hooper has transformed a footnote to English history into a resonant fable of challenge, achievement, and friendship across class barriers, creating a period piece that speaks eloquently to the present. Top movie number 7, Inside Job. Charles Ferguson's lucid, searing documentary about the 2008 financial meltdown exposes the fundamental delusions of the chummy bigwigs who created it, said Richard Corliss in Time. This is a true-life heist movie in which the thieves not only got away with their billions, they're still doing business. Ferguson manages to stay calm when confronting the malefactors, but most viewers will blow a gasket. Most popular movie number 8, a dizzying blend of drama and history, this five-hour biopic details of the extraordinary career of the international terrorist known as Carlos the Jackal, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon.com. A forceful and dynamic performance by Edgar Ramirez anchors French director Olivier Assayas' tale of violence, daring, and intrigue. As soon as it was over, I wanted to watch it again. Number 9, Black Swan, Darren Aronofsky's dark psychological fantasy, delights and disturbs, said Christy LeMire in the Associated Press, showing a fascination with the minutiae of preparation that will be familiar to his fans. The director of The Wrestler has spun a nightmare tale within the seemingly gentle yet fiercely competitive world of ballet. And the 10th most popular movie of the year, 127 Hours. Only Danny Boyle could make this inspirational true story about a trapped rock climber and an edge-of-the-seat adventure saga, said Claudia Puig in USA Today. In the latest from the director of Slumdog Millionaire, a virtuoso performance by James Franco and stunningly kinetic filmmaking put us inside the head of outdoorsman Aaron Ralston, whose courage, determination, and will to live helped him survive a horrific, near-hopeless situation. And those were the top 10 movies, according to the film critics, for 2010. Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine, dated January 14th, 2011. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it. Remember, we're reading The Week Magazine rather than U.S. News and World Report these days. Be sure to listen to us next time. We hope you've enjoyed the program today. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.